Welcome to Move Well to Live Well, a podcast where we discuss all things health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Belle Moody, a physical therapist specializing in pelvic health. This podcast is here for you to help educate, motivate, and elevate your life. Let's get into it. Hello and welcome to the Move Well to Live Well podcast. My name is Belle. I will be your host. I have my co-host here with me again. Miss Johnette Sheridan, so glad to have you.
So happy to be here.
Today we are talking about longevity, aging, lots of different things in that aspect. I don't really like the phrase anti-aging, but that will probably come, or we'll talk about that some also. But main thing we're focusing on is what do healthy and happy elderly people have in common? Because if we're looking at longevity, this is the population that gives us the most insights are people over the age of, well, it depends on, you know, what you're wanting, but really people over the age of, you know, 70, 80 that are moving and living well into those ages. So we have done some research, and we're just going to kind of share what we've learned and talk about different things. But the first aspect of longevity and aging that I'd like to bring up is the physical. What are things physically that happy and healthy elderly people are doing and how they're presenting that we could look to in order to implement those things in our own lives. So, yeah. Do you have any, Johnette, that things that, like, off the top of your head you notice or know of from a physical standpoint, whether it be exercise or whatever else, that you're like, this 100% increases longevity or, yeah.
I mean, I think as long as you just stay consistent, then that's going to be your golden ticket to just be able to keep it going as long as you can. If you keep doing it, you're going to be able to keep doing it.
Yep.
I know we said that before in other podcasts, but like my grandparents, they are 80, be 84 this year, and they're 82 this year. Mm-hmm. And they have a treadmill, a bike, like a stationary bike, and like a rower, not like a rower, but like a different kind of rower situation, yeah, in their garage. And my granddad goes out there for about 45 minutes every, like, 5 days a week, and just That's is awesome. Moving. And then Nana, she likes to claim that she does a lot of, I guess we could also consider the neat activity. Like, she walks, yeah, through the house constantly, like walking up and down the stairs. They have a set of stairs in their house that they have to go up and down multiple times a day. That's where their bedroom is versus like where the kitchen is. So that's something else that they get that maybe a lot of people that are older don't have. Yeah. They don't have stairs in their home. But so they are, they just are moving around every day, which is great. And I feel like that has helped them continue to be able to do that.
That's awesome. That is so awesome. I know from a, like, physical therapy standpoint, I've worked in lots of different areas, clinic areas, one being the nursing home. That was actually, most recently, I worked there kind of, I guess you could say, as a sub to help them out in the nursing home. And it's funny you say that about stairs, because that's one of the questions you need to find out when you're doing an eval on somebody. Your first appointment is like what their home environment is like. And really, stairs, when you find out that somebody does have stairs, then you got to figure out, like, where's their bedroom? Is it stairs to get to the bedroom or whatever else? Because it can be such a huge limiting factor and dangerous if the strength is not and the balance is not there for them to be able to navigate the stairs well. So Exactly like what you're saying, if they're continuing to do it and they're doing it every single day, going up a flight of stairs, like up and down multiple times a day, I mean, there's no reason, but barring anything like major medical event happens, that they shouldn't be able to continue doing that until, you know, the rest of their life. So, one thing I found interesting, I remember one of our professors in PT school talked about it was a newer research study that had come out. This was back in, I've been out of that, it was like my first year of PT school, so 2019. So it was kind of a little bit longer ago, not as new as it was then, but they found that your grip strength was associated with increased longevity, like if you had stronger grip. But then that's another thing with studies like that, you don't know like what all, is it really just grip strength or is it strength in general, like overall, that is playing a part on their the rest of their, you know, well-being. So don't, you know, start like grip exercises or anything solely because but I think it was more of the bigger picture is what wanted to take away from it, is like the stronger you are, and I do know that that's true, your muscle mass and strength improves your longevity overall. So from a physical standpoint, what we have read and seen is that just don't stop. Oh, and that podcast we had listened to that we talked about, it was the Mind Body Green, and they were talking about walking.
Oh, yes.
Like how just walking like 30 minutes a day plays a huge part on your longevity. So, yeah.
And like walking also after you eat is a really big, it's a lot, there's way more benefits than just you're moving for the day, but also like how it regulates your blood sugar and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah.
And digestion and all that. So,
and blood sugar. I really wonder, I need to read and look into this more, but I think there's such a like key component of glucose on your lifespan, like, and things like that. So yeah, I don't know enough to say anything about it right now, but, there's some book. Anyway, I'm just going to, like I said, I don't know about it, but I definitely think it plays a huge, huge, huge part, your glucose management throughout your life. Another thing that we have found to consider from a longevity standpoint, anti-aging standpoint, is your emotional well-being. And I guess we could lump maybe emotional and spiritual kind of together, separate but also together. But there are, I know that you have read about the importance of community and what's the word I'm looking for, fellowship, yes, on the lifespan. Do you mind telling us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Having people that you visit with frequently, whether it be your family or your friends that are outside of your home, but having that regular communication, connection, whether it's over meals or just visiting outside or traveling to your friend's house, that has that connection, that feeling of being included, that validation, that communication, talking. Just the fact that you're talking to someone else, like if you live alone, or you know, getting out to be with your friends or family, like I said, it is so crucial to I guess our happiness or our emotional well-being as we age. I've read a little bit about this, and also I've watched some of the documentary regarding the Blue Zones. I know it's a big topic of conversation right now, but that's just, there's areas in this world, there's five or six areas that have the longest living people, and like, so they're kind of like a documentary about these areas and what are they doing, how are they eating, how are they living, what are their commonplace things that they do to live so long and live so well. And one of the big components or the aspects of living long and living well is the fellowship, the community, the connectivity, the communication, that feeling of like being with people and not being isolated. So
that is, yeah, it's almost convicting for me, because I really like being by myself, mm-hmm, a lot, mm-hmm, and it seems it is so much easier to be by yourself. I feel like make that choice and just be. Anyway, so being intentional to have time with other people and stuff, I didn't realize how much of a, mm-hmm, factor that plays on your lifespan and well-being. I was looking at the NIH, National Institute of Health, but also the National Institute on Aging, and they had a bunch of their most recent studies throughout the recent years, and I was just kind of scanning through them, and there's one that talks of, or basically shows the data behind what Johnette's saying, that social factors may predict your mortality risk for older adults. And they found there was a questionnaire called the Social Frailty Index. And I don't know the exact questions and how it's rated and stuff like that, but basically it just asks you questions about your social habits, and depending on how you answer and how isolated you are, they found a association with increased mortality risk, increased mortality risk. So, and just to kind of break that down, that just is that you have a higher chance of passing away from a variety of different things. And so some of the questions that I did find off of the index were, do you go out less frequently compared with last year? Do you sometimes visit your friends? Do you feel you are helpful to friends or family? Do you live alone? And do you talk to someone every day? That's only 5. I think it's 10 items in total. But anyway, I could see, especially as getting older, my answers being probably pretty poor on that index. And one thing that in PT school we've talked about is there are lots of different factors that happen with aging that will make you more isolated or at risk for more isolation. So if you lose your driver's license, if you're not able to drive anymore from vision impairments, hearing impairments, whatever it might be, that when you are not able to drive anymore, especially if that's your primary form of transportation. I realize that there are some places in the U.S. where driving is not, you have tons of other options to get places. But basically, if you are not able to transport yourself anymore, it sends your independence into the trash can. And so then, that in itself, just knowing that you've lost that independence, will affect your social, confidence a lot. And another thing is hearing. I didn't realize how much that plays a part on your confidence in social settings too. As I've worked with patients, I can tell they don't want to, they don't want to reveal that they didn't hear you or they didn't understand, and then they feel like they can't contribute in the conversation. And so, and that's a whole other conversation, I'm sure, for those who are hearing impaired that, might not be elderly. That's a lifetime of struggle, I'm sure. But anyway, that plays a huge part into that confidence, social confidence as well. So let me double check, because I wrote down... that's everything from the social standpoint. I don't know. I don't have any research. I didn't look this up beforehand about from a spiritual standpoint, but I do know that in some of my classes in PT school, it is a really important factor for you to feel spiritually fed and I guess well, in a sense that you have something from a spiritual standpoint that you associate with. Johnette, I don't want to speak for you, but we are both Christians. Are you okay with me sharing that? Yes. We are both Christians, and I know that in my life, I can totally see how, and that's my opinion, that's what I believe firmly. It fills my life significantly, my relationship with the Lord, and but I can see just from a spiritual standpoint in general, trying to be like not biased right. towards any certain type of religion, how if you don't have something like that, how it could significantly affect the way you operate through life. Like that's what gives me hope through most days and all days and things like that. So, I don't know if you wanted to, do you have anything on that note that you'd like to share or?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, with that, I think having spiritual, spiritual aspect a part of your life, then you have that sense of structure or that like tradition, mm-hmm. like it's something you do every day, it's at a certain time, or you go into the same place and, you know, have your practice, whatever it is, that there is that semblance of routine. Again, like if you're doing it, you know, by yourself, then there is kind of like it helps fill you up, and then it helps it, you know, technically, I guess, kind of sustain you throughout the day. So when you have troubling, you know, interactions or, you know, hard times or stress or what have you, you have that to fall back on. So that is something that kind of is reliable that you can stay connected with even in the difficult times. And then if that is paired with also with people, then that's another way to fellowship and connect with humans and yeah. and you know, and you know, whether you're doing it, you know, spiritually or religiously or, you know, what have you, there is that level of hope like you mentioned, and also like that kind of, for me at least, it brings joy. And so that's a whole nother like optimism side of things that yeah. helps maybe change your outlook on what you have for the rest of the day or the week or the month or yes. whatever.
I just pulled this up, just Googled it as you were talking, just to see if there's anything data-wise. But this is a study from 2022, and it says the relationship of spiritual well-being with life expectancy and quality of life for patients living with heart failure. So heart failure, just to give you a brief synopsis, is a really devastating diagnosis to get, because once it starts, it just becomes this domino of other conditions that you're just trying to manage and keep okay for as long as possible. And so anyway, as a patient, I could see how that, knowing that you have heart failure, even the word itself, failure, and the heart it being your lifeblood, you know, of you being able to keep going, can be extremely discouraging. So I think knowing that, and then also thinking about the spiritual impact on having such a detrimental diagnosis, it makes this super significant. But it says the conclusion of the study was that spiritual well-being, it says especially the existential type, enhances life expectancy and quality of life among heart failure patients. Therefore, it is recommended that healthcare professionals design a comprehensive and supportive care model for the promotion of spiritual well-being in heart failure patients. So, so anyway, I knew that, I remember us talking about it in school, and from there's these, we learned Eric Erickson's like stages of life or psychosocial stages. Very interesting if you're looking into something to like look up. And it goes from birth to death. And what's so cool is that he theorized that like there were two roads that you took as you developed psychosocially. And so one is if you passed through successfully and got what you needed and And then the other was if you didn't, like if trauma caused, you know, or something stunted that portion of development. So like from one of the first stages is, I think it was like care versus something else. And it was basically like, were your parents there to soothe you as a baby? Or did you have no outside and then you kind of fail that stage. And then, so it's so interesting because the end of life stages were the most interesting to me. The two were, it was like, if you made it through successfully, you were, really happy with your life. You looked back with fond memories, even though obviously your life was not going to be filled with the most, like, everyone's guaranteed to have struggles and trials and things like that. But overall, you felt very positive about your life as a whole, and you were just at peace with, and this is like your ages, I think it was maybe like 70 and up. And then the other stage, if you didn't pass through, was a lot of like bitterness, hatefulness, trying to, being judgmental towards other people, trying to make them feel less than in their life because you felt less than in your life psychosocially. So anyway, yeah, so I can definitely see in it, there was a spiritual component through those stages as well. So, yeah, very interesting. Eric Erickson.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard that before.
Yeah. Wait, I'm thinking of Leif. Leif Erickson. Leif Erickson Day. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
Hold up.
What?
Leif Erickson.
I feel like, should I know this? I'm going to feel silly.
It's a scene, or they talk about him on SpongeBob. That's what I'm thinking of. He was a Norse explorer who is thought to have been the first European.
I remember that name.
First European to set foot on continental America, approximately half a millennium before Christopher Columbus. Leif Erickson. But then there's an episode of SpongeBob where they're talking about Happy Leif Erickson Day. Anyway, but Eric Erickson is the sociologist or whatever. Potentially. No. Potentially related, though, in some form or fashion. Maybe grandpa and, yeah. Okay, and then lastly, we have the nutrition category. And one thing that I found that was pretty interesting was there was a recent study in 2023 that found that cutting calories by 12% for 2 years, but this was done in lean or slightly overweight adults, so fairly normal body composition. They cut their calories by 12%, improved their metabolic age, but it was over 2 years in total. So they weren't doing it like it wasn't a huge significant drop or anything. But and I've also read some other things about how fasting can and different things of that nature. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't want anyone listening being like, oh gosh, now I need to go cut my, please don't do that. Please don't do that. Or like worry about that. This is yeah. Anyway. So, just something to think about. And there was also another study that I found that, hunger has a positive association with RNA, like the replication of your, in an anti-aging portion too. So I think that kind of go together, that cutting calories and then having slight, I think basically just listening to hunger cues is what it boils down to. So but with yours, with your research and all, now question, do you know why it's called the Blue Zone?
No.
Okay. I don't either. That's what
I feel like I did at one point. No, maybe
I'm gonna Google it. Blue Zone. But okay, while I'm looking that up, do you have anything that you know from a nutrition standpoint that are related to longevity, improving it, and different things like that?
So this is not medical advice, just to say that disclaimer. I'm not a nutritionist. This is just based on what I've read, what I've researched. from online sources, from books, that sort of thing. So I was first introduced to the concept of Blue Zones from a friend who had a cookbook that it nothing but includes recipes that people that live in the Blue Zones use. And it's pretty cool. Like it's, I think it's either five or six, like I've mentioned, Okinawa is one, in California, I think it's one of those in California. There's five to six of them. And it just kind of, the cookbook goes through the, yeah, there's one, it's right near, I think it's like across a highway of like a very popular main, I'm blanking on the names of this, the cities of these names, but
wow.
Name of these cities. But anyways, so it goes over the five to six areas and like the recipes that are common in those areas. And one of the things the book was talking about is how, I'm going to say 25, but it may be a different number, but like they primarily kind of like cycle through 25 or so ingredients in their cooking. And so that's relatively simple. And then they just make them, you know, make their meals within those like family of ingredients. And I think one of the things to talk about how that helps with digestion because your body is used to those ingredients kinds of things. But then further research was talking about like how more specifically what they eat and what they don't eat in the Blue Zones or in those areas. They are predominantly plant-based. Mm-hmm. So there is meat consumption is significantly reduced based on the average American diet. So, I mean, we're talking 2 to 3 ounces of meat 5 times a month. Mm-hmm. That's like on average.
That's my kind of
diet. Yeah. And then they do eat fish maybe 2 to 3 times a week. But they get their protein from other sources, protein from, you know, so tofu, lentil, quinoa, that kind of thing. And so dairy is also reduced. And if they do eat dairy, they eat the full fat dairy, like the full fat goat cheese or goat's milk, sheep's milk, that kind of thing. And then some of the bigger like categories of food, beans, nuts, lots of vegetables, fruits. And a couple of things that were surprising is they, you know, drink coffee, tea, water is their main beverage, but also red wine. So on average that they have like 3 small glasses of red wine a day. So just there's, I guess, the resveratrol or like the different properties within red wine. Yeah, that's a lot of wine.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, like that's not every
and
person.
It's like, it is like an 8 ounce.
Who knows? So 8 ounce? So like it's a typical wine pour is like a 5 ounce, like
Yes.
So like, so I don't know exactly how many ounces they're drinking, but uh-huh. It talks about, you know, 2 to 3 small pours of red wine is common in these areas. So other than that, then they're predominantly drinking, you know, water, tea or coffee.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And then the sugar is very low. Like I'm talking 7 teaspoons low per day, the way to do that is like if you're eating the whole foods,
yes.
The whole ingredients, whether they're cooked or raw, as opposed to the processed, so the significantly reduced processed or if any processed foods, you're eating the whole foods and then you're using animal products sometimes for flavor or to enhance the flavors of the meal you're making, but it's predominantly plant-based. Full fat, higher quality dairy from sheeps and goats, and lots of beans. They generally eat beans every day. Mm-hmm. And then all the bread, they primarily focus on sourdough bread.
Wow.
They eat sour. Yeah. Uh-huh. Sour is what they say. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. Like that kind of plan, yeah. Or that kind of like the categories of food, like nuts, they eat nuts, like a couple handfuls of nuts every day.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. I know that in recent, I guess, years, it has, like, the carnivore diet has become really popular. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, keto diet has become really popular. And a lot of times, I wonder, and I'm just saying this, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, but I just wonder You know how I've seen some people saying that like beans are super inflammatory for you. And I'm like, in my mind, there's just no way. But if there is from a research standpoint, what it's interacting with that's causing the like more inflammation, like in our, like the more the processed stuff, like the, what it's coming into contact. Is it that's, because that's how I prefer to get my protein is through beans, legumes, if you will. I do too. I don't know if I ever say it right, but I like to attempt. but anyway, and then like you look at these, also I looked up Blue Zone. It's exactly what you said, Jonna. The term refers to geographic areas in which people have low rates of chronic disease and live longer than typical areas. Yeah, man, it just makes me wonder, like, because I know, like, you can look up anything and make it fit your agenda, what you want, your confirmation bias, you know, and so I have seen certain stuff about plant-based being like, you're missing certain things, but then when you look at the Blue Zones and anyway, it just makes me wonder, what is it in our, especially in America, like what is it in America that might be causing data to be skewed, if you will. Yeah. So
I've also watched lots of documentaries about like just the meat in the U.S. and its processing and the different factories and stuff. And there's a couple other documentaries out right now. One is like it compared twins that are identical twins, and one followed a carnivore diet, one followed a vegan diet for, I think, 4 months, 12 weeks. Yeah. And so that was like that was the best way for them to actually get accurate data, and they
identical DNA. Cause
yeah, like otherwise, like there's so other many, there's many factors that kind of contribute to things being different, but like it was a very fascinating documentary, and it was on Netflix. I think I can't remember what it was called, but it went into a lot more than just like following this set of twins around, but because they did all these tests from mental, physical, sexual, weight, you are what you eat. Thank you, Bill. That's what it's called. But it tested them in a bunch of categories, and then it tested them throughout, and then at the end, and then they share their results. And it was pretty fascinating how the different categories were affected based on the diet. And, you know, as far as like losing weight or losing fat or gaining muscle, because they also followed a similar workout regimen, and they had their meals were provided for them for the first, I think, 4 weeks. And the last 4 weeks, they cooked for themselves based on, like, the plan that they were given. But so, like, as far as, like, weight loss, there wasn't enough time for it to see, like, a huge difference. But there was some change if they adhered to the guidelines. But in other areas, there was significant changes, like in the sexual arousal side of things. The vegan diet participants, like, it blew up off the scales, like how they had the ability to, I guess, be more aroused, or how they scale that. It was very interesting. But so that was another thing that's popular right now that's out there. But I think regarding meat and processing in this country, you know, these big companies monopolize, you know, and they people know more about this than me, I'm sure, but I'm just saying from what I've watched is like it is to make things back in the, I think, 40s and 50s, they had to make things cheaper, and so then that over the years has just lessened the quality of the food that we get, and that causes a domino effect for the land in which the animals are on, the surrounding areas, and then it takes domino effect into the people that buy the food, consume it, and if they get sick, and then that kind of, I don't know, it kind of all ties together, like how it's kind of contributing to a lot of health factors and health issues through people. But one of the things in the documentary about the Blue Zones was talking about how, you know, they eat a little less. They try to, like, the first one was in Okinawa, the first episode, and one of their main things is they try to stop at 80% full. And I feel like one of the big things that in America, mm-hmm. our portion sizes are huge.
Yeah.
And
I'm hurting.
Yeah. And then, like, and also other research from other nutritionists I've listened to, it's like it takes 20 minutes for your brain and your stomach to connect. Mm-hmm. So if you slow the heck down when you're eating, wow. you won't eat as much so quickly. And then, so anyway, so that kind of, it all kind of goes together. But with the eating of meat and dairy, you know, if we could be more conscious about the type that we're getting, and if we could just eat a little less of it, then it would slow down, possibly, if we all work together, right? Yeah. If we all work together to slow down the high consumption of these animal products, then, you know, maybe eventually one day, if I'm optimistic enough, you know, then yeah. like the just the quality overall could be better. But because it's just consumed in mass, mm-hmm. it has to be consumed so much, has to be consumed, it has to be produced so quickly,
yes.
and cheap for people to buy it. And so it's just kind of like a cycle that just kind of is perpetuated. And so if you do eat meat, just try to eat a better quality meat, and then just maybe eat less.
Yeah.
yeah. So like wild caught fish versus farm raised fish.
Yeah.
It's not as fatty. It's higher quality.
Yeah.
You know, if you could get beef that is, you know, awesome, it's on like a regenerative farm,
yeah.
or someone you know,
yeah.
like has a cow, yeah. you know, or whatever. Or if chicken, you know, if you know, the labels are a whole lot of things that they steer you in directions that aren't necessarily real and true.
Yes.
So, like, for example, cage-free versus pasture-raised. For, you know, for years, I thought cage-free, well, that was the pinnacle. That was the
yeah.
best. And then, technically, they still may just have 10 inches
yeah.
of space versus,
mm-hmm.
like, pasture-raised. That means they actually have the full for chickens and stuff. So it's just... You know, it's just interesting as you more and more you read about it, your eyes open and you
wow.
and you get a little bit more. I don't know. Yeah.
I want chickens really, really bad.
Yeah.
But,
so cute.
Oh man, that'd be sad. Our cats would kill them immediately. They would not make it past day one. But that's what, and Will, they poop on everything.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we need to build an enclosure and have them. But I have a former patient who they raised chickens, but they also like would raise them. They had egg chickens and then they also had meat chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought that was really cool that they had, they knew exactly it was, you know, their chickens. I couldn't do it. I couldn't like do any of the processing and stuff or anything. But I thought that was really like refreshing and nice that, and super sustainable. Like they used everything, like recycled or, you know, made every piece of the puzzle go to, you know, some type of use, which
yes.
was awesome. So, anyway, and then I don't know if you've heard of this, you probably have, but I can't remember when, I think they passed a bill recently, maybe the USDA or something, about allowing for synthetic beef production to be sold in like Walmarts and different things like that. Have you heard of that?
I mean, like, The vegan like alternative plant based, no different than that?
No, from what I understand, and I could be wrong, is that now they have allowed for, or legally they can be putting synthetic beef products into what you think is actual beef products without revealing it anymore. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait.
I got to read about that.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
That's
terrifying.
USDA. Okay, okay, this is it. This was in June 22nd of 2023. Also, this is coming from The Guardian, so please, you know, look this up yourself. But it says, the U.S. becomes just the second country in the world after Singapore to allow the sale of meat grown from animal cells in a lab. So, USDA allows lab-grown meat to be sold to U.S. consumers. And I don't know about labeling or anything like that, but from my knowledge, what I remember reading is that it does not have to be labeled that it's lab-grown meat compared to actual meat. So, anyway,
that's
but
interesting.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's like, you know, I'm sure there's some pros, or else it wouldn't have been, you know, I don't know, but yeah, something to think about, kind of talking about, you know, making it cheaper, mm-hmm. making it more accessible, mm-hmm. being able to produce more, mm-hmm. provide more for, yeah, so anyway, yeah. But very interesting. Also, we're about to run out of time, but I have heard, I don't know if you've heard about this, that this is not related to nutrition at all, but that a lot of anti-aging studies go back, or their basis is looking at the telomeres of your DNA, which are the caps on the end of each piece. And so they found, I got very mixed stuff from when I was looking at this, so please take this with a grain of salt, because I would read one thing and then I would see something else, so I could be misinformed on this. But from what I understand, if your telomeres, the caps of your DNA, are longer, it is associated with less chronic disease, overall improved health, longevity, that type of thing. And then when they're shorter, it usually corresponds to impaired health in some version or another. And so sometimes, or I've read, and now this is one that really went back and forth, but they said that through pregnancy, or there are different ways that you can lengthen your telomeres, improve the health of your DNA, but one is by being pregnant. And because, and I think it is because it's stopping that replication of cells of your period. You're not getting that, like, turnover every single month. So I think it kind of goes back to the menstrual cycle some. But like I said, I read lots of different things. It was like some went with this way, some went that way.
Well, that has something to do with, like, the stem cells, like how your baby in there is creating its, I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I bet it does. I bet it does. The other, on the con side of it, I saw the stress that your body undergoes can affect it in the opposite way. So, I don't know. So, I saw both. so that, I thought that was interesting, was that the telomeres, or going back to DNA, like, I'd be curious about the Blue Zone people, if they if they know any, or if there's any data on that. So anyway, but well, do you have anything else, Johnette? Okay, this was so great. Also
fun.
Yeah, for those listening, me and Johnette are actually in person together today, so this made it even more fun, because usually we're just over virtual, if you will. Thanks for listening. I hope that this was helpful in any form or fashion to you, that you can be encouraged. There's so many things that you can start doing. And really, what it boils down to is just the simpler, the better. You know, your ingredient list, keep it low, hang out with people, spend time with people, and move and keep moving. Yeah. So from a longevity standpoint, there, we solved it. They don't have to do any more research. So, okay. We will talk to y'all next week. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. You can meet us and work out with us in person at the Studio Bar and Wellness located in Starkville and Lewisville, Mississippi, or move with us online at www.thestudiobarandwellness.com on Studio Stream. Our goal is that you move well to live well.